Why do I conduct my show in this manner? Mundo!
Sweet mother of God, what is the holdup?
Eleanor!
Once again, something wonderful in my life has been turned into a giant crap fest.
Mundo!
Got a little bit more cock for you here.
Eleanor!
Bowtie boy got the big snaggeroonie.
Mundo!
Oh, six of my nipples are tingling.
Eleanor!
See why America loves him so much?
Mundo!
I'd like to smash you in the face with my shillelagh.
Eleanor!
I have no idea what's going on.
Mundo!
Who's lying?
He said he never tells a lie.
He was lying when he said that.
Eleanor!
I want a cup.
Well, could you spill that?
C-U-P. I want to see you. Oh, my God.
I know nothing. Nothing.
Atomic batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
For God's sake, strap yourself down.
That's right. It's the show your bosses don't want you to listen to. The show that's going to tell you the truth about what's going on in the workplace. So wake the hell up. It's the Cup of Joe radio show. I am your not-so-humble host, Joe Vecchio, the voice of the working man, the voice of the radical middle, and the voice of those who have been unvoiced by the anti-worker policies of the Bush administration and its corporate allies. Our engineer, Sock Puppet Sam, is here!
Hey, Joe, what do you know?
And we've got a lot of stuff to talk about, but first, Sam, give us the URL for the site.
That's cupojoe.blogspot.com.
And the email address.
joevec@bellsouth.net.
All right, I want to welcome all of my fans listening in at the White Rose Society. That's whiterosesociety.org. My good friend Ben Birch hosting my archives there. And, of course, all my fans at rantsradio.com listening in on Thursdays and Sundays. It is Wednesday, August 4th, 2004, about 1:17 p.m., as it says in my clock. As you know, those of you listening on Rant Radio, I do not do this show live. This is all pre-recorded. And I do that for several reasons. Number one, I cannot hear on Thursdays to do the show, first of all. And it's a little bit more difficult for me to do a show on the fly sometimes. And I just find it a little easier to pre-record stuff. It gives me a chance to get settled and stuff like that. If the occasion ever arises where I'm doing a live show, it'll be under different circumstances because I'll have people with me. I mean, no one really does a radio show by themselves. You know what I mean? They have producers and they have other people helping them out. Which is fine, you know. I mean, that's the way it is. I mean, nobody just walks in and does things by themselves. And the better shows, I think, have people talking to each other back and forth. I think one of the reasons why Howard Stern is as successful as he is, and I'm not a big fan of his because I think it's, you know, it's adolescent humor at best. But one of the reasons he's successful is that he has people on that he talks to and that emphasize his personality. So, and that's why I'm better when I'm doing interviews than I am when I'm rambling on like I am now. I had one of those days at work yesterday that really were kind of a pain in the butt. And really, our work is now divided into like three different parts because we have two breaks. We have a 15-minute break at 5:30, and then we have a half-hour lunch at 8 o'clock, and then we go home at 11. We start at 3. So approximately 2.5-hour work times. And the first part, as usual, everything took a while to get started because no one's really sure what we're going to be working on. And once the supervisors, you know what's going on, sometimes they don't know what we're going to be working on. They have to check with their supervisors. And it takes a while to get set up. So usually like the first hour or so is just basically just getting set up. And then we really start working in earnest about an hour into it. And it started like that, and it was just like moving as slow as molasses. Do you ever have a period like that at work? And usually it's like the last hour before you go home, you know, on Friday. But this was like a Wednesday afternoon, and it's like everything's moving like molasses. And then you just feel like everything's taken forever. And then in the middle of the day, it kind of picked up. And the end of the day, they changed up parts. And it, again, took a while for us to get set up. And I was having problems that the torque screwdriver, the torque was too much for the screws I was putting in. And it turned out that we were putting the wrong screw in. Not my fault. I was putting in the screw I was told to put in. And I thought it was the right screw anyway, frig me. But it was just it just got really, really bad. And it was one of those days you wish you would have just stayed home. And I wish I could afford to stay home more often. I had 2 days off last week, one because of the inventory and one because I wasn't feeling good. And actually, I went to the doctor for that. So I only get paid for 3 days this week. So it's not going to be as much as it usually is. So I want to thank, by the way, the people who donated some money. I didn't get a lot. You know, people can't afford to donate. And I understand that. And I don't like to pressure people to donate money. If you can afford it, and I certainly don't want anybody to spend the milk money or whatever, your grocery money on me. I mean, I'm okay. It just, it's nice and every now and then you get a little bit of something through PayPal. So if you want to donate, click on the Make a Donation thing on the blog. If you don't want to donate, there's no pressure to it. I mean, I do this show for free, and I don't really expect any money from it, but it's nice every now and then I get something. Where was I? You know, I was reading my usual blogs, and one of the blogs I usually read is called Hullabaloo. It's by a guy named Digby. At least I think his name is Digby. And he's pretty good. He doesn't write as often as Atrios or Kos, or Kos, I should say, does. Because I don't know why. He just doesn't. He doesn't write as often, but he writes very well. And he writes in kind of a similar style to I do, with a lot of anger and a lot of it very straightforward. And he was talking about, he had something on the other day that really hits to some of the things that I talk about how politics now. And the article was entitled "The Politics of Image and the Vision." And I'm going to read this out for you and comment on it as I read it out. He starts out talking about, and this is from, what is this from? This is from the New York Times, an article. It says, "White House and Bush campaign officials have long said that the details matter," and they're talking about the war on terrorism. "The details matter far less than the pictures and sounds of Mr. Bush talking in any way about his campaign against terrorism, which polls show is his strongest card against Mr. Kerry." Excuse me. Now, according to Digby, and I'll read verbatim what he wrote here, and I'll comment on it. "This is the kind of thing that should be ground out by every single Democrat on radio, television, and in print. The White House believes that the details matter far less than the pictures and sounds of Mr. Bush talking in any way about terrorism." Pointing this out, and also the loyalty oaths demanded of the crowds, the fake backdrops, the refusal to hold press conferences and explain their policies, could go a long way toward educating the public about what a bunch of phonies they are. And phonies is what they are. I mean, they do this all the time. They'll say one thing and then just do something completely opposite. Now, back to Digsby. "We haven't done this, and as a result, Karl Rove's dictum about politics being TV with the sound turned off remains absolutely true. Unless half the country has ingested so much lead that their IQs have been cut in half, there is no other explanation as to why people see this dancing monkey as a great leader. It's the images." And that's partly true. But also partly is the reason why half the country doesn't vote is people don't think it matters. And they really don't think politics is any good on one side of the border or the other, or one side of the one party or another. It doesn't make a difference to them. They're all the same, as far as at least half of the people in the country is concerned. Now, the other side of this formula, of course, is their rapier attacks against the Democrats. "The Bush campaign has said that its convention will use humor and derision to criticize John Kerry." Josh Marshall of CalPundit points out that, excuse me, Talking Points Memos, points out that this propensity for ridicule seems to be built right into the DNA, right into the right's DNA. And let me quote Marshall on this. "Republicans are very good at this, and it can be a tool that is deceptively difficult to respond to or to combat. Effective mockery is sticky, hard to shake off, and hard to parry, and it appeals to people's appetite for fun and humor." Indeed, it's not just contemporary Republicans who have a knack for this. There seems to be something intrinsic to the reactionary or right-leaning mentality that gravitates towards this method of political combat. If you think of the Tory pamphleteers and essayists of the 18th century in Great Britain, or others in a more recent vintage in the U.S., and the Tory is essentially a conservative or slash Republican. It's basically the same type of deal. Margaret Thatcher, think that. Back to Digsby. He says, I think this is because the right is essentially authoritarian, and group derision is one of the most powerful weapons in the bully's arsenal. Frat boys, heathers, which are basically girl bullies, street gangs, insider cliques of all kinds, use it to terrorize the loners and coerce loyalty from those who do not want to be a target. In fact, forcing others to join in the cruelty is the actual point. And Digsby adds that he has loathed and resisted this dynamic his entire life. It may be the single most important reason why he's a Democrat. He just can't stand those assholes. And that's one of the big points that I wanted to talk to. Because that's exactly why I'm not a Republican. And, of course, people naturally assume I'm a Democrat. And I am to a certain extent. But I do not have the kind of loyalty to the Democratic Party that the hardcore Republicans have to theirs. And I really, really do see the Republicans, and especially the leadership, and especially Mr. Bush and his administration at the top of that pyramid, as just being nothing more than bullies. They are very good at putting themselves in positions where they don't have to be held accountable for their actions. Putting themselves in positions of power, it's tilting the playing field so that things go smoothly for them, so that the actual operation is just an after effect, getting everything set up, getting everything ready. And that's what they do with the talk radio and with Fox News and things like that. In fact, Paul Krugman had an excellent article, which I'm going to get to later on, about how Fox News and other media outlets work towards this. They're just assholes. I can't think of it any plainer than that. They're just a bunch of snotty, self-serving, bigoted, racist assholes who only have something to say when it's putting down. You know, and the guys on the talk radio in particular always bitch about how Democrats don't have a sense of humor, and what they really mean is that Democrats won't laugh when we kick someone when they're down. If Democrats, liberals don't have a sense of humor? Who knows? Some of the greatest comedians were liberals. Groucho Marx, the Monty Python gang, they're all liberals. They're all social liberals. Yeah, they like money, but being loving money is something that is both done on both sides. Alan Alda on MASH, both the character and the person. The character of Hawkeye and the person. They're very funny people. I've got a wonderful sense of humor. But I don't laugh. I don't think it's very funny when, you know, people are being kicked around in the streets. Or like for example, on a show like Cops, where they've got some poor schmuck that they're ridiculing because they're either drunk or on drugs or just plain stupid, and they're making fun of them. I don't find that particularly amusing. And because I don't find that thing amusing, according to them, according to the right-wing people, I just don't have a sense of humor, and that's horseshit. I've got a great sense of humor. You can ask my wife. What was that old joke from Monty Python with Graham Chapman, the late Graham Chapman, playing that brigadier general? You know, now nobody likes a good laugh more than I do, except perhaps my wife and some of her friends. Oh, yes, and Captain Johnson. Come to think of it, most people like a good laugh more than I do, but that's besides the point. I love that. Anyway, to continue what Digsby was writing about. Excuse me. Let me get a drink of water here. My throat's been bugging me lately. Hang on. All the damn medicine I'm taking now. But he goes on to say, it's a very powerful social force that asserts itself in various ways from childhood into old age. Right now we seem to be in one of those periodic cultural eras in which these kind of adolescent, anti-intellectual social types come to the foreground. And he adds, there's no greater example than the president himself. Fuck Saddam, we're taking him out. And that's an actual quote from Mr. Bush. And this was while they were still in the process of supposedly trying to determine whether he had weapons of mass destruction or not. Years before, or months before we actually went to war, excuse me. It's hard to fight in this environment, and while I am all for ridiculing Digsby, that is, for ridiculing them right back, I'm afraid that most liberals are never going to have quite the flair for it that they do. We have way more genuinely funny guys and gals deflating the hypocrisies of our times, but the bullies have that nasty coercive streak that really gives this stuff its punch. Laugh, you pussies, unless you want a piece of this. Now, Digsby says he's spent a lot of time interacting with activist Republicans in years gone by, and you'd be surprised at how lame we lefties generally are at this game. The bullies have spent their entire lives eating reason arguments and pleas for civility for breakfast. Still, they think it's a good idea for us to keep at it. They really hate being made fun of. Even if most of us can't strike that perfect, snarly, bitchy tone in our mockery, we can still bother with them with it. Unfortunately, however, in the long run, the Democratic Party really can't indulge very much in these high school games because the fate of the world depends upon somebody rising above this immaturity. For all of our fractiousness and various feints, left, right, and center, we are the grown-up party. God help us all. You know, he's really hit the nail right on the head with this. You know, and that's why, you know, people say, why don't you be more confrontational? Why don't you get, you know, right-wingers on the show and just slam them all the time? Look, and for me, I'm not that good at that. You know, I get angry. I get seriously angry. And when I lose my temper, it makes me look bad. And that's no good. I stick to what I do best here. And others do it much better than I do. And I let them do that. But it really is true. I cannot sustain that kind of anger for very long. I just can't. And I just like to talk about things and, you know, here's a problem, how do we fix it? That's my attitude about a lot of things. And sometimes I can be very blunt, it's true. And there's a lot of people that I piss off at work sometimes because I have a very straightforward attitude about stuff. Well, not a lot of people, but there's a few people. As my coworker Dave points out, there's just a lot of people who just simply can't accept me for what I am, as I am. And that's part of it. I mean, I can accept a lot of different people, and, you know, and I can learn to live with them. And there are some people that piss me off more than others, and there are some people that just naturally get on my nerves. I don't know why, but it's just the truth. But as for being just overall angry at a single group or stuff like that, I can't even be angry at Republicans all the time, even hardcore Republicans. As much bullshit as Mr. Bush and his administration have done to this country, as much damage they've done, my whole attitude is, look, just get them the hell out of office. You know, I don't care if they don't go to prison or anything like that. Just get them the hell out so they quit fucking with our lives. Let them go and spend the rest of their years living on their yacht, having fun, doing something, whatever. But just get them the fuck out of government. You know? And I'd be willing to forgive it. If it all ended tomorrow and we actually had some sensible policies, and I mean, and again, I don't even know why I have to point this out, that I'd be all in favor of using preemptive strikes or whatever if there was actual proof that somebody was a real threat to us. But that was never the case with Iraq. But you can't get it through these guys' heads. Excuse me. This whole you're with us or against us mentality is fucking horseshit. And they're real good at it. And you look at them though in their little snotty responses and their snide remarks, and that's exactly what they are. They're just bullies. Finally, the thing finishes up with talking about when Janine Garofalo was on Sean Hannity, and apparently she did not fare very well. The biggest liberal in the Senate line that the Republicans use against, you know, Kerry or Edwards, whoever they feel like, is entirely predictable. And Garofalo should have had the facts on hand, a ready diversionary feint or some sort of snarky takedown. This isn't really a complaint about Ms. Garofalo, who is a really good actress, by the way, and very funny. The Democrats just don't seem as armed for combat as the Republicans, even when they know very well what the Republican talking points are going to be. Garofalo is a very sharp cookie, but she needs some help. God knows the Republicans help their talking heads with staff and Oppo researchers and clip services up to here. If Janine and the others are going to be voices for the Democrats in the media, they need some backup. And that's another thing that I've talked about, how there's very, you know, the Republicans pay people to do shit like this. All of us bloggers, Atrios, Coase, Digsby, We don't get money from the DNC. I don't get a fucking cent. I ask people for a little help. I get maybe $10 here, $20 there, no big deal. But I don't get a lot of money. I certainly don't get enough to support myself. I still have to spend my time working for a living. Excuse me. Man, I got a lot of stuff in my throat. So, you know, it's not like I'm getting big bucks doing this. I do it because I feel compelled to do it. And fighting back in the only way I know how, which is just talking on the radio and hoping that somebody listens in. I know what I'm good at and what I'm not good at. You know? But the truth of the matter is, like Digsby said, we all have to kind of rise above this. And sooner or later, not the Republican leadership or the people who are pushing this stuff, because they're fanatics, and I don't know if they're already lost, but God Almighty, it's going to be difficult for them to get out of that mindset. But the people who have supported the Republican Party in the past and who use that sort of type 2 faith, a type B faith, where they vote for Republicans because their parents have voted for Republicans and their parents voted for Republicans, they need to take a better look at what's going on. You know, because there's certain lines that you simply don't cross. I mean, politics is politics, and you always expect a little bit of dirtiness involved with it because it's the nature of the game sometimes. If you're ambitious and you want power, that's great. You know, the Democrats have done that for a long time. The only difference is, what do they do with the power? And that's what I talk about. What do they do with the power? And, you know, if you look at results, if you look at history, at least history since the end of the Civil War, it's basically been the progressives. Whether you're talking about progressive Republicans like Teddy Roosevelt or the Party of the New Deal later on in 1932, the Democrats, they're the ones that have made conditions better for this country and made this country greater than what it once was. Anyway, I'm going to come back with Al Sharpton's fantastic speech at the Democratic National Convention. I snagged that. And we'll hear from my friend Bart Kopp. And we'll be back with more Cup of Joe Radio Show. Sam, take us out.
We'll be right back with more of the Cup of Joe Radio Show.
Tonight, I want to address my remarks in two parts. One, I'm honored to address the delegates here. Last Friday, I had the experience in Detroit of hearing President George Bush make a speech. And in the speech, he asked certain questions. I hope he's watching tonight. I would like to answer your questions, Mr. President. To our chairman, our delegates, and all that assembled, we're honored and glad to be here tonight. I'm glad to be joined by supporters and friends from around the country. I'm glad to be joined by my family, Kathy, Dominique, who will be 18, and Ashley. We are here 282 years after, right here in Boston, we fought to establish the freedoms of America. The first person to die in the Revolutionary War is buried not far from here, a black man from Barbados named Crispus Attucks. 40 years ago, in 1964, Fannie Lou Hamer and the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party stood at the Democratic Convention in Atlantic City fighting to preserve voting rights for all Americans and all Democrats, regardless of race or gender. Hamer's stand inspired Dr. King's march in Selma, which brought about the Voting Rights Act of 1965. 20 years ago, Reverend Jesse Jackson stood at the Democratic National Convention in San Francisco again appealing to preserve those freedoms. Tonight, we stand with those freedoms at risk and our security as citizens in question. I have come here tonight to say the only choice we have to preserve our freedom at this point in history is to elect John Kerry, the President of the United States. I stood with both John Kerry and John Edwards over 30 occasions in debates during the primary season. I not only debated them, I watched them. I observed their deeds. I looked into their eyes. I am convinced that they are men who say what they mean and mean what they say. I am also convinced that at a time when a vicious spirit in the body politic of this country that attempts to undermine America's freedoms, our civil rights, our civil liberties, we must leave this city and go forth and organize this nation for victory for our party and John Kerry and John Edwards in November. But let me quickly say, this is not just about winning an election. It's about preserving the principles on which this very nation was founded. Look at the current view of our nation worldwide as a result of our unilateral foreign policy. We went from unprecedented international support and solidarity on September 12, 2001, to hostility and hatred as we stand here tonight. We can't survive in the world by ourselves. How did we squander this opportunity to unite the world for democracy and to commit to the global fight against hunger and disease? We did it with a go-it-alone foreign policy based on flawed intelligence. We were told that we were going to Iraq because there were weapons of mass destruction. We lost hundreds of soldiers. We spent $200 billion at a time we had record state deficits. And when it became clear that there were no weapons, they changed the premise for the war and said, no, we went because of other reasons. If I told you tonight, to let's leave the fleet center, we're in danger. And when you get outside, you ask me, Reverend Al, what is the danger? And I say, it don't matter, we just needed some fresh air. I have misled you, and we were misled. Faced with the prospect of in the next 4 years that two or more Supreme Court justices' seats will become available. This year, we celebrated the anniversary of Brown versus the Board of Education. This court has voted 5-4 on critical issues of women's rights and civil rights. It is frightening to think that the gains of civil and women rights and those movements in the last century could be reversed if this administration is in the White House in these next 4 years. I suggest to you tonight that if George Bush had selected the court in 54, Clarence Thomas would have never got to law school. is about living up to the promise of America. The promise of America says we will guarantee quality education for all children and not spend more money on metal detectors than computers in our schools. The promise of America guarantees health care for all of its citizens and doesn't force seniors to travel to Canada to buy prescription drugs they can't afford here at home. The promise of America provides that those who work in our health care system can afford to be hospitalized in the very beds they clean up every day. The promise of America is that government does not seek to regulate your behavior in the bedroom, but to guarantee your right to provide food in the kitchen. The issue of government is not to determine who may sleep together in the bedroom. It's to help those that might not be eating in the kitchen. The promise of America is that we stand for human rights, whether it's fighting against slavery in the Sudan. But right now, Joe Madison and others are fasting around what is going on in Sudan. AIDS in Lesotho or police misconduct in this country. The promise of America is one immigration policy for all who seek to enter our shores. Whether they come from Mexico, Haiti, or Canada, there must be one set of rules for everybody. We cannot welcome those to come and then try and act as though any culture will not be respected or treated inferior. We cannot look at the Latino community and preach one language. No one gave them an English test before they sent them to Iraq to fight for America. Is that every citizen's vote is counted and protected, and election schemes do not decide the election. It, to me, is a glaring contradiction that we would fight, and rightfully so, to get the right to vote for the people in the capital of Iraq in Baghdad, but still don't give the federal right to vote for the people in the capital of the United States in Washington, D.C. Mr. President, as I close, Mr. President, I heard you say Friday that you had questions for voters, particularly African-American voters. And you asked the question, did the Democratic Party take us for granted? Well, I have raised questions, but let me answer your question. You said the Republican Party was the party of Lincoln and Frederick Douglass. It is true that Mr. Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation, after which there was a commitment to give 40 acres and a mule. That's where the argument to this day of reparations started. We never got the 40 acres. We went all the way to Herbert Hoover, and we never got the 40 acres. We didn't get the mule. So we decided we'd ride this donkey as far as it would take us. Tradition. Those that have emerged with John Kerry and John Edwards as partners, like Greg Meeks, like Obama, Barack, like our voter registration director, Marjorie Harris, like those that are in the trenches. And we come with strong family values. Family values is not just those with two-car garages and a retirement plan. Retirement plans are good, but family values also are those who had to make nothing stretch into something happening, who had to make ends meet. I was raised by a single mother who made a way for me. She used to scrub floors as a domestic worker, put a cleaning rag in a pocketbook, and ride the subways in Brooklyn so I'd have food on the table. But she taught me as I walked into that subway that life is about not where you start, but where you're going. That's family values. And I wanted somebody in my community. I wanted to show that example. As I ran for president, I hoped that one child that come out of the ghetto like I did could look at me walk across the stage with governors and senators and know they didn't have to be a drug dealer. They didn't have to be a hoodlum. They didn't have to be a gangster. They could stand up from a broken home on welfare, and they could run for president of the United States. As you know, I live in New York. I was there September 11th when that despicable act of terrorism happened. A few days after, I left home. My family had taken in even a young man who lost his family. And as they gave comfort to him, I had to do a radio show that morning. When I got there, my friend James Ntoumé said, "Reverend, we're going to stop at a certain hour and play a song, synchronized with 990 other stations." I said, "That's fine." He said, "We're dedicating it to the victims of 9/11. I said, "What song are you playing?" He said, "We're playing America the Beautiful." In the particular station I was at, they played that rendition sung by Ray Charles. As you know, we lost Ray a few weeks ago, but I sat there that morning and listened to Ray sing through those speakers, "Oh, beautiful for spacious skies, for ample ways of grain, for purple mountains, majesty, across the fruited plain." And it occurred to me as I heard Ray singing that Ray wasn't singing about what he knew. Because Ray had been blind since he was a child. He hadn't seen many purple mountains. He hadn't seen many fruited plains. He was singing about what he believed to be. "Mr. President, we love America. Not because of all of us have seen the beauty all the time, but we believed if we kept on working, if we kept on marching, if we kept on voting, if we kept on believing, we would make America beautiful for everybody. Start November, let's make America beautiful again. Thank you, and God bless you."
"I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, 'I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.'"
Listen now, you mother...
There's a website fighting President Bunny Pants every day.
BartCop.com.
Bart Cop mixes unrelenting outrage and piercing humor with his favorite fine tequila.
BartCop.com.
On the web since 1996 with news and commentary not approved by Karl Rove.
BartCop.com.
Live chat rooms to discuss Bush's crimes of the day.
BartCop Radio.
Uncensored invective aimed at those who deserve it most.
BartCop.com.
Fighting the Bush family evil empire.
BartCop.com.
But we need your help.
Go there now.
"I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore."
BartCop.com.
Group, an unrehearsed, hastily assembled program presenting inside opinions and forecasts on major issues of the day. With Jack Germond of the Baltimore Sun, syndicated columnists Pat Buchanan and Eleanor Cliff, and Morton Kondracki of the New Republic. Now here's the moderator, John McLaughlin.
Issue number one, the commander-in-chief in Mexico. Bush wants a free trade agreement. What does President Salinas want? Pat Buchanan.
John Salinas is playing up his recent economic success and steering his country toward...
Jump on!
I don't think it's so much what Salinas wants. It's what
Eleanor
the Americans...
Cliff.
John, this is just another case of President Bush trying to push a policy...
I'm not sure Bush has a policy, which
Excuse
is part
me,
of the
Pat,
problem.
I believe Eleanor has the floor.
Thanks, John. The hard truth is that Bush... needs Salinas more than Salinas.
I think this agreement talk is basically a...
Wrong! There will be a free trade agreement. It will take place within 1 year. Issue number number two, Maggie out, Major in. The new British Prime Minister. Some believe he's a Thatcher clone. Will he carry out her policies? Chuck, come on.
Well, Thatcherites are privately rejoicing.
Wrong, Mortone.
See, Thatcher endorsed...
Wrong! On a scale of 1 to 14, 1 being lowest degree of likelihood, 14 being absolute metaphysical certitude, what are the chances of Major continuing Thatcher's alliance with Bush vis-a-vis the Iraqis? Eleanor Clift.
I'd say about a 12.
Pat Buchanan!
Hold it. 14 is most likely.
Yes?
I'd have to say about a 9.
Jack Jamon!
Lower, like 5.
Mortone!
8.
Wrong! The actual degree of likelihood is 6.5. Issue number 3, life after death. Some pundits say it doesn't exist. Theologians disagree. Is there an afterlife? Chuck, come on.
I really don't know.
Mortone!
Well, it's not my field.
Dr. Cannon!
I'd like to believe, but it's...
Wrong! There is life after death. The soul does not ascend to heaven, but rather rests in a limbo state that varies depending on the karma of the spirit. Issue number 4, intelligent beings on other planets, yes or no? Pat Buchanan!
I would think so, but...
Eleanor Clift!
Don't know.
Jack Jamon!
Me either.
Mortone Town!
Well, no one really knows.
Wrong! There is intelligent life in the 11th galaxy on the planet Neptar, which will conquer Earth in the year 5482, utilizing us for slave labor and the Shalonian salt mines. Issue number 5. What number am I thinking of? Pat Buchanan!
Jeez, 82.
Wrong! Eleanor Clift!
Is it between 1
don't
and 100?
Don't skirt the issue!
40!
Wrong! Mortone Tyne!
212.
Wrong! Jacarino!
2.
Wrong! The correct answer is 134. Issue number 6, what did you have for breakfast today? Eleanor!
Some cantaloupe.
Mortone Tyne, USA!
I had poached eggs and toast.
Jack Jamundo!
Bacon and eggs.
Patty Patty Buke Buke!
I'm thinking waffles, maybe.
Wrong!
A little...
Wrong! You all had Special K with banana. Issue number 7. What is issue 14 going to be? Some say it will deal with an economic matter. Others believe it will involve Germany. More teeny tiny tabletop.
Oh, acid rain?
Wrong! Eleanor, gee, I think you're swelling on.
I have no idea.
Wrong! You know quite well. You're just shy. Mondo, Jackalope, G-Man, Mania,
well,
Jack...
it might be.
I'm not finished with your name, Jamonical. Jack-O-Lantern, J-G, Jimmy, 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 Mayhem.
You're insane, John.
Wrong! I'm perfectly sane. Everyone else, however, is insane and trying to steal my magic bag. St. Patrick of Buchanonomics.
I think I'm going to leave, John.
Wrong! You can't leave. All the doors are locked from the outside. Next issue. What motivates me? Why do I conduct my show in this manner? Mondo!
You're a jerk.
Eleanor!
Really large ego?
Wrong! I was neglected by my parents, and I overcompensate to shadow my feeling that I have an inadequate intellect. Next issue!
So, you didn't know your parents very well?
Wrong!
Wrong?
Wrong!
Right?
Wrong! Next week, the SNL probe continues. Is my money in a savings and loan? If so, what's my account number? Bye-bye! Wrong! No!
And we're back on the Cup of Joe radio show. I am your not-so-humble host, Joe Vecchio, the voice of the working man, the voice of the radical middle, and the voice of those who have been unvoiced by the anti-worker policies of the Bush administration and its corporate allies. It is actually Thursday afternoon as I'm speaking, 11:23. That was Dana Carvey with the late Phil Hartman and John Goodman with their spoof of the McLaughlin Group. You can tell how dated that is because the Bush that they're talking about is the first Bush. That was from way back in 1990 when John Major became Prime Minister of Britain, a position he held until Tony Blair took over in 1997. I thought you guys would like to hear that because that's what I used at the beginning. Mondo, Eleanor, that's what I use at the very beginning. Also, I wanted to kill a few minutes here. My wife is in the hospital right now. They're not sure really what's wrong with her. She's in for tests. So I'm going to go visit her a little later as soon as they put her in a regular room. She's still in the emergency area because they haven't been able to find a room for her yet. They're very crowded at Grady. So until then, I'm just going to kind of, I want to just finish off the show so I can get it in the box, and then we're going to go take care of some business there. I'm put a notice on the board. Hopefully, there's nothing serious, and I'll be back on Sunday night with no problems. But if it's serious and I wind up having to spend a lot of time at the hospital, there will be no Sunday show. But hopefully, it won't be too bad. She just got a very high cholesterol level, and they're worried about it. And they're just going to see what's going on there. And hopefully, again, it's nothing serious. Anyway, you know, another reason I played the McLaughlin Group thing is because, you know, it's a real media circus. And it's funny because I remember when the McLaughlin Group came out, there were a lot of people who were just kind of saying, oh, it's not really news. It's just, you know, it's just crap. And the sad part is, you know, the McLaughlin Group is still on the air, I believe. But it's really kind of mild compared to a lot of the stuff that we have now. And the media is just a real circus. And these people are not doing their jobs. You know, all this, you know, all the people bitching about Michael Moore saying this and that. The really truth of the matter is, and one of the points that Michael Moore was trying to make, is that if the press was doing its job and not so busy just being, you know, whatever the hell they are, cheerleaders for the right or just a bunch of obnoxious jerks more in tune with their own egos than they are with the real important issue of being journalists, then things wouldn't be as they are right now. Bush probably would never have gotten into office because he has never gotten the kind of scrutiny that even a Michael Moore, who is not a politician, I mean, he is an advocate for political causes, but he has never run for office. He has no intention of running for office. He's just a political agitator, basically. And he is being held to a much higher standard for truth than the President of the United States, who sends people to war. And let me read this something here from, this is from Paul Krugman, the great columnist for the New York Times, one of the few really, really good columnists out there remaining, because all, you know, so many of them are just, you know, even on the liberal side, you know, the Maureen Dowd is supposedly liberal, but she's more like the, you know, the hoity-toity, you know, pinky in the air, you know, gossip columnist is basically what she is. But Krugman, who normally talks about finance, and he does talk about economics very much, but every now and then he gets into the political stuff. And he had an article just talking about how the press deals with things. And let me read you some of that. Commercial broadcast TV only covered an hour a night of the Democratic convention. And we'll see whether or not Republicans get equal treatment. C-SPAN, on the other hand, provided comprehensive commentary-free coverage. But many people watched a convention on cable news channels, and what they saw was shaped by a script portraying Democrats as angry Bush haters who hate the military. If that sounds like a script written by the Republicans, it is. As the movie Outfox makes clear, Fox News is, for all practical purposes, a Republican propaganda agency. A now-famous poll showed that Fox viewers were more likely than those who get their news elsewhere to believe that evidence of Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda links had been found, or that WMD had been located, and that most of the world supported the Iraq War. CNN used to be different, but Campaign Desk, which is run by the Columbia Journalism Review, concluded after reviewing the convention coverage that CNN had stooped to slavish imitation of Fox's most dubious ploys and policies. I don't want to say something here about that because CNN used to be really, really good back when it was run by Turner. They were very straightforward and pretty fair, and they had their share of political stuff, of course, you know, back and forth. But, you know, the biggest problem I see is that these guys aren't journalists anymore. They're media celebrities. And it's a point I've brought up from time to time, and I will continue to bring up. Back in the 40s and the 50s or so, before television news, and I know they had radio news, but really, most people got their news from newspapers. And the beat reporters of the time, especially when you're talking about local beat reporters, where these sort of things were discussed, they made roughly the same amount of money as the working people who bought the newspapers. Maybe in some cases a little less, in some cases a little more, depending on, you know, how good they were. But they made basically the same money as everybody else. They didn't have this huge disconnect. Now, most people get their news from television, whether it's cable news or network news, it doesn't make a difference. And the anchor people on these shows and the people who are supposedly the journalists, they make so much more money than guys like you and me who are just out there working for a living, that they have absolutely no friggin' clue of what life is like for us. And they really treat us with disdain, for the most part. Mr. Krugman continues. He said, second ever John Kerry's speech, CNN gave Ed Gillespie, the Republican Party's chairman, the opportunity to bash the candidate. Will Terry McAuliffe be given the same opportunity right after President Bush speaks? Commentators worked hard to spin scenes that didn't fit the script. Some simply saw what they wanted to see. On Fox, Michael Barone asserted that conventioneers cheered when Mr. Kerry criticized President Bush, but were silent when he called for military strength. If you look at the video clips at Media Matters, there was tremendous cheering when Mr. Kerry talked about a strong America. I mean, the Fox people were just lying. They were lying through their teeth. And the evidence is right there. And the problem is a lot of people are simply too friggin' lazy to go and look it up themselves. Another technique pervasive on both Fox and CNN was to echo Republican claims of an extreme makeover, the assertion that what viewers were seeing wasn't the true face of the party. Apparently, all those admirals, generals, and decorated war veterans were ringers. It'll probably be easier to make a comparable case in New York, where the Republicans are expected to feature an array of moderate, pro-choice speakers and keep Rick Santorum and Tom DeLay under wraps. But in Boston, it took creativity to portray the delegates as being out of the mainstream. For example, Bill Schneider at CNN claimed that according to a New York Times CBS poll, 75% of the delegates favor abortion on demand, which exaggerated the poll's real finding, which is that 75% oppose stricter limits than we have now. But the real power of a script, and the script that he talked about is something he got from the Daily Howler, and he talked about how the Daily Howler has discovered that it's basically like a script that they follow so that they don't really have to do any real reporting, real journalism. The real power of the script is the way it can retroactively change the story about what happened. On Thursday night, Mr. Kerry's speech was a palpable hit. A focus group organized by Frank Luntz, the Republican pollster, found it impressive and persuasive. Even pro-Bush commentators conceded at first that it had gone over well. But a terrorism alert is already blotting out memories of last week. Although there is now a long history of alerts with remarkably convenient political timing, and Tom Ridge politicized the announcement by using the occasion to praise the president's leadership in the global war against terror. And this is what we've come down to, ladies and gentlemen. And Howard Dean pointed out the political timing and all the political timing of the terror alerts, and all the media was screaming, oh, that crazy Howard Dean, you know. And meantime, Tom Ridge says, oh, the president's bold leadership has caused this. Catherine Harris goes on to say at a speech somewhere, that there have been hundreds of terrorist attacks that have been foiled by this administration. And, you know, it's all a bunch of shit, ladies and gentlemen. Ignore the media. Ignore them. The professional media is hopelessly out of touch with what is going on in this country, what is going on in the world, and we are the worse off for it. Simply ignore them. They are not worth our time. They are not worth our effort. Keep up criticizing them like Media Matters does. Keep on criticizing them like Daily Howler, but do not take them seriously as news organizations anymore. Do not. You know, at Nuremberg, remember that not only did government leaders of the Nazis were put on trial, but members of the German media were also put on trial because they were complicit. And these people are complicit in what the Bush administration is doing. They are his enablers, whether they're doing it willingly or not. Ignore the professional media because they're not doing their jobs. You're getting much better work out of the blogs, especially places like JuanCole.com and Daily Coast, who are really following the elections very well. Ignore them. But don't ignore me. I have to go. You all have a good one. Hopefully I'll see you Sunday, and I'll keep you posted on what's going on with my wife. Until next time, it's Joe Vecchio from the Cup of Joe Radio Show saying goodbye. Goodbye. Joe Vecchio, the host of the Cup of Joe Radio Show, is proud to be a member of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 2127. However, the views of Joe Vecchio do not necessarily represent the views of Local 2127, the IBEW, or its affiliate, the AFL-CIO. Please remember to support your working brothers and sisters and help keep the American dream alive. The Cup of Joe Radio Show has been a production of Jove Enterprises, Incorporated.